To the close detail of Art Left's Swindling and Selling, let's back out a bit and consider what we are contributing here to the evolving understanding of how lawyers ought to think about social activity. The lawyer's theory of social action, I have said, is really an effort by conciliant reasoning from multiple different academic disciplines or intellectual styles of inquiry to provide a lawyer with a rich and reinforced view of what is going on around her in society, an understanding which could help at every level of generality from what it is that we are doing when we are asking questions in a deposition, or what we are doing in the coffee breaks in a painstaking read-through of transactional material with clients or with counterparties, to what it is that we think we're about when we're trying to plan a large-scale social campaign in press and public relations and in community outreach and community relations and in the preparation and filing of litigation and in negotiation with public officials over large public controversies in development or environmental rights or voting rights or any one of a number of other areas in which whatever we are doing as lawyers is only part of what we are doing as campaigners, advocates, or citizens. The lawyer's theory of social action, then, is, as Darwin says about the theory of evolution by natural selection, a view of life, not merely a view of biological life, not merely a view of climate science or geology's effect on the human species, and not merely a matter of a social psychologist's sensitive understanding of the functioning of the repression of cognitive dissonance, nor entirely based upon a political theory of the marginal voter, nor a completely based upon a Platonist understanding of the value of guardians of enlightenment for even a republic. Indeed, not only anything. This is why just is so often the problematic word in lawyer sentences, because unless it has to do with some version or another of the concept of justice, it's usually a mode of exclusion. This is just that, it isn't anything else. And it is unifactorial thinking, unifactorial explanation, unidirectional perspective, which is the primary adversary of the kind of enlightened social thinking, sensitive to environment and to the currents of opinion and to the needs of the moment and to the realities of the way the law actually works, which is necessary if the lawyer is to do his job and make things happen in society using words. When things are happening in society, they are happening among human beings, and human beings are hominid primates. And if one takes a look, as we will in a little bit, at what it means to conduct chimpanzee politics, then one begins to understand that it is like that among us, where like that, oddly enough, implies both the, well, misogynistic hell that is chimpanzee life, with quite different and not exactly polar matriarchal, but nonetheless extraordinarily rearranged society, which is bonobo. A point which is as clear at when we begin to think about the anthropology, just a step past those hominid primates to the persons actually considered Homo sapiens, when we think about the relationships that have characterized the discussion of the Dionysian and the Apollonian forms of North American indigenous native culture, which really, after all, might mean the people we call Iroquois, who call themselves Haudenosaunee, and the people we call Hopi, who, well, or Zunyi, and who maybe use those names, but not our conceptions of what it means to be a people. Just as we can say, then, that the level that is biology and the level that is culture and its interpretation, which might be far apart on some vertical diagram, are really adjacent parts of the overlapping way in which we think about the social life around us. Felix Cohen has spent, after all, almost as much time thinking about the fact that equipping police cars with radios is a social force as he has spent thinking about the difference between Lakota and Acoma. So if we are trying then to construct an approach to the phenomena near around us, which are, you know, lawyer phenomena, contracts, and whatever we mean by torts, and something we designate property at the moment, just to think about those fundamental forms of common law liability in which your attention is at present engrossed, or when we are thinking about the difference between constitutional law as understood in the United States Supreme Court to exclude what are known there as political questions, and what we would say about constitutional law everywhere else, which is that it is only made about political questions, and whether those questions are about the rights of individuals conceived in our, and I do mean our, certainly my idea of what privacy is on the one hand, and what it is that privacy means in the law of, well, pick your place, the People's Republic of China, or the nation of India, or the day-to-day affairs in a crowded and under-resourced part of Cairo. There are only pretty much crowded and under-resourced parts of Cairo, except the parts which are part of the state that is the army, which is, of course, another way of thinking about how it is that certain principles of chimpanzee politics are reflected by a lawyer's theory of social action pretty much everywhere. We are, in other words, interdisciplinary borrowers and thieves of ideas and techniques. We can occasionally return the cup of sugar that we borrowed. Well, we can return a different cup of sugar, which in the law of bailment is an important distinction, after all. In the medieval understandings of the causes of action, whether you can bring detonate for it or only debt ultimately turns out to be important, which turns out to be significant to the law of contract. We are told in a piece of business we call Slade's Case, and which at least once upon a time a very fine criminal lawyer oddly decided as a little side trip into legal history was the moment at which capitalism destroyed the pre-capitalist virtues of the common law. An odd story, but then you can make Slade's Case into anything unless you really understand what it is that they are worrying about. The nature of our phenomena, whether they are, as I say, the first-year law school concern with the ordinance of common law liability, what it is that it differentiates contract and tort and property, a simple thing, not difficult to understand from a, well, from a lawyer's socially informed point of view, but a mystery, by and large, to first-year law students, if you do grasp what is the fundamental category organization of contract, tort, and property, which I will mention later on in this hour. You can take for free the fundamental insight which everybody really actually needs in order to shine in the blue books at the end of those terms. Whether we're considering this fundamental simple question, what are contract and tort and property about, or we are simply sitting opposite a former homicide detective who is now a cyber crimes investigator and who has unfortunately sized up our client better than we have. Whatever it is that we are about as lawyers, whether in high theory or low practice, what we are really doing is watching social phenomena and trying to understand quicker than everybody else what they mean at more than one level. And to do that, what we have are the tools that we have borrowed stolen and misused and put together in consilient ways to overlap in such a fashion that we have a quickly and comprehensively illuminated stage on which the performance in society that we are watching is reflected for us from enough perspectives that we can see what it really is. But then, of course, I'm anticipating, because that's just one sociologist's way of thinking about how we watch what goes on in society, the dramaturgical approach that Irving Goffman thought up and that Art Leff stole. But again, what's important at the level of detail at which I now hope that we are operating, which is just for a few moments more, not about Leff or about contract, but about how a lawyer's theory of social action works, we think about what it means that the people we are in the room with are hominid primates, and we think about the way in which their individual psyches are constructed. And we understand, as we shall see next week when we come to Frank Putnam, whose arrival in our course I have accelerated because last week's relationship to Carl Wiley turned out to be so much more complex than it usually is in this term. We think about the individual psyches and their organization, and we are thinking about the ways in which the different minds in the room, ours, the detectives, and our clients, are interacting and influencing one another, and that will bring us to the line where the sociologist and social psychologist that is Irving Goffman will be worrying about the presentation of self in everyday life, which will turn out to depend in part on what a culture thinks a self is, in a way that Cliff Geertz can help us to think about from the anthropologist's point of view. And all of that may bring us back around in a loop towards some conversation analysis which helps us to understand how it is that clients speak to detectives and how detectives speak to clients and what we might want to do about it when it all starts to go wrong. A moment in my early life of practice, which is never very far from me, as certain moments of disaster in the early life of your practice will be never all that far from you, I suspect. And so we go back and think about things afterwards. We frame experience, another matter of Irving Goffman's interest, at the other end of his career, just about the time that Art Leff was writing Swindling and Selling, which bears just the slightest sign of having been based in part on frame analysis, which is, after all, there are all sorts of underutilized forms of social science about which nobody happens to write PhD dissertations anymore, about which a lawyer might still be terribly, terribly interested. It's that terribly, terribly interested part which is important. It's the curiosity of lawyers, you see. Now, of course, the curiosity of lawyers is an underestimated quality because so many lawyers are Coral Wiley, and they're not curious. It's the incuriosity of lawyers who can sell all their thought processes at a very high price without having to change them or really reconsider them at all, which is the thing that is the enemy of creativity in the practice that you all think. I think the enemy of creativity of is simply money, which it isn't. I don't think that the history of culture from, let us say, the year 1100 to the day before yesterday when Kim Kardashian and Kanye West were deciding to pack their marriage in, I don't think the history of creativity demonstrates that money is particularly good at making people more creative. The difference between the starving Schubert and the comfortable Mendelssohn is not, unfortunately, the quality of the music. It isn't Mozart in poverty or Mozart in comparative wealth when there are a few extra dollars around, or the resentfulness of Beethoven about what he hasn't got that makes them, well, creative. And it's not evident to me whether the great revolutionary John Lennon and Paul McCartney were more creative in their comparative Hamburg squalor than in their later profusion of wealth. There's a part of me that deeply wishes, of course, that John Lennon had never bought an apartment in the Dakota. But then, that's only because that's where Mark David Chapman shot him. The benefit of wealth, which everybody perfectly understands, and which I also believe you ought to have in lawyering, unlike the benefit of incuriosity, which allows you to knuckle down and sell your services without ever having to rethink them, and if it's profitable, then aren't you comfortable doing it? And the answer is no. The real difficulty in knowing how to keep your practice agile, to do the things which are good for you in the stage of life where you are, to satisfy the intellectual and moral and political and ethical, and if the point is that there should be more categories, psychic health of your life in your practice. The real enemy of knowing how to make it new every day, make it new, is that incuriosity can be sufficient in a lawyer who is in a niche and who therefore sees little need to come out of the niche, unless there is, of course, some deeply unsatisfactory moral, ethical, political, social crisis in which the lawyer's niche comes to seem more like a coffin to her. And we maybe exaggerate the problem when we think of it as that sort of high onset crisis, the dramatic urge to say about it that we came to a particularly hard moment in the practice. There was a particular crisis, and therefore we had to change our lives, quit, turn away. But although you can see in the history of a tree or of a man the portions of the growth that were interrupted by trauma and the success in radical healing, which allowed that trauma to be overcome and life to be better in some new way. Whether you are looking at the tree or the man, you know that the success at dealing with the apocalyptic nature of the trauma is not a guide to the value in the tree or in the human being of the periods of peaceful, harmonious, and well-watered growth, in which also change occurred and things were made in a new way, but without tearing. When your practice is under other people's control, of course, it's more likely to be tearing. Which is possibly, of course, why I am telling you that you should always be aware of the ability to create a practice under your control. But that ability requires the curiosity which feeds the creativity. And the curiosity must not be dulled by the comparative success at any given moment of the practice, whether it is complacency or anxiety, the discovery that you are keeping your head above water or growing your wealth by doing the thing that renders you incurious now there. There is the enemy against which education can direct its fire. Good learning makes more learning and more curiosity and more creativity and therefore more social empowerment and more self-empowerment and less indifference and I don't care and maybe even therefore more appreciation for the rights of queers. So when we look at people making deals, we see a lot of things. Of course, if you're in the beginning of your experience of contracts and Lucy against Zahmer presents you two people selling and buying from their bar stools, it would be helpful to be able to think about the ways in which the Pst Buddy and the Squaresville Pitch could meet with a little bit of alcohol on two bar stools, and something could go wrong that the courts will have to do a bunch of settling out later. In order to understand the way in which any deal is done, or any accident is compensated, or any goldsmith's cheating of a chimney sweep's boy can be thought of as an action of trover, we need a rich enough account that the case in the casebook feels to us just like a schematic diagram. The most important lines and dots filled in, the colors of the wires carefully asserted, but not necessarily what the whole of the thing meant in the place where the device was when it worked and what people did with it and how they felt about it, all of which may indeed be deeply important. Whether Mrs. Quickly is right to be concerned about the sea coal fire or the hat, Holmes is only being a mite unfair, since anything which helps us to predict ultimately the incidence of the public force is relevant as law, and the law is more than the prediction of what the courts will do in fact once one begins to acknowledge that it is also the moral deposit of the race or the guide to the pathology of civilization or any one of the other things in which, though we are lawyers, we are not just lawyers only, and we are also always aware of when we are sitting wherever we are sitting and watching whatever the play is. To recognize that it is play in more than one sense is simply to be ourselves when we are there, to have our senses of irony and humor along, and to need them. Artlef wasn't humorous and also an insightful and deeply effective teacher of thoughts about the law. Artlef was both, and that was part of why, even when he was very sick and ill and about to die, he was humorous. I know, because I was there. So, a lawyer's theory of social action is a bag full of other people's tricks, drawn from the great ideas about human life and society, and using them from moment to moment in order to achieve consilient levels of understanding from multiple directions at once to add clarity to what we are experiencing as lawyers in real time, therefore helping us to make things happen in society using words. If we want to understand what Leff is thinking about, the pieces of social behavior which he is analyzing, the way that deals are actually done and how the law applies to them, it is apparent that we need some microeconomic theory of the firm and role theory, as he calls it, which is really the dramaturgical approach to social behavior in the context in which we work on producing the impression that others have of us, and are ourselves therefore inclined to look at ourselves as others see us, deeply impressed and influenced by the impression we think they have of us, that we think they are being affected by us to have. All of which is, as the idea Freud tells us, unconscious behavior, subject to the patterns that the unconscious applies to it that come from our histories as human beings and from the nature of the makeup of our minds, about which more next week.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in the turning on your light, baby, the light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby, I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right. So it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I'm told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind, you could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kinda wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's alright.
Understanding that we are watching the performance of efforts to make what we are to others in society what we would wish them to be, the management of our impression, helps us to understand from moment to moment why the sale works, or the swindle works, or why in any given moment we're just watching the same moving parts, whether they are swindles or sales, because we are watching performance in society in which the impression management of the people, the Marx desire to seem cool, the Khan's desire to seem genuine, the Marx desire for the Khan to be as genuine as he seems, and the Khan's desire for the Mark to be as naive as the Mark is trying not to seem to be, and the fact that therefore it is the less naive Mark who is the more easily swindled, well, all of that is what Left gets from Goffman. From the presentation of self in everyday life, for the most part, from the ideas that began Irving Goffman's career as an extraordinarily influential sociologist and social psychologist, but which are, for Left, just instruments, little spoons in which to provide distorted reflections of what it means for Sean Makis to be fooling a dentist in Riverdale, or what it means, for that matter, for Enron to be fooling the entire stock market and the people of Texas who, as we know, just never get anybody to look after their electricity who isn't swindling them. But we too, I mean, you know, as law students and law professors, are ordinarily engaged in many of the same kinds of dramas, now, as you understand, produced mostly for Zoom, which is a, well, what shall we say, not the best medium for it, and hard to analyze, but even harder not to wind up just ignoring. Which is why it's such a bad tool for teaching, and why it is that you're feeling so worried about underperforming, which is not, in fact, the danger that you're in at all. But you can't tell, because you're alone, and you can't see how much of the presentation which is being made to you is desperate reworking of old clothes, not quite made new, by people whose primary terror is that they still don't know how to do this thing that they're hoping that they're only going to have to do until, by God, it will be normal again one day. If the President of the United States thinks that it is possible that we can be approaching normal in the United States by the end of the year, then you should understand that whatever it is that Columbia Law School and Columbia University think they're thinking about whether it's going to be normal in the fall semester, you should write that possibility largely off. But everybody is still performing, being on the verge of normal, which Goffman would say is part of how they deal with their no longer being public spaces in which public behavior can occur. The stage has been obliterated. It's been digitized and boxed and put in Zoom, and nobody's methods work correctly, yours included, of course. But then you didn't have any prior experience with how to be a law student, and they are fighting all of the prior experience about how to be law teachers. But this would be the same if you were selling and buying something other than legal education. Because, of course, one of the important things about the way the deals are done is that they're done somewhere. Bargaining in a souk requires a souk. And whether Americans, in their hatred of public speaking and the, well, what shall we say, standard white person's view of how to bargain in America, have led to the supermarket aisle rather than to the souk or the bazaar or the marketplace of any village in southern North America, whatever it is that yields the spaces within which things are done is what yields how things are done, and whatever eliminates the spaces with which in which things are done changes the doing. This is the case of the bargaining over the telephone as opposed to in the marketplace, as it is the case of the law school education over Zoom, or the radio, for that matter, as I am doing it now, and the theater of the classroom. The dramaturgical approach to social life won't do everything. Nobody thought it did, including Goffman. But it will do something for the lawyer, whether that lawyer is performing in a courtroom or performing in a conference room, or whether merely sitting carefully, absorbing how other people are performing in those places, intelligent watching of the performance has been the way to become a better lawyer since the yearbooks began to be made. Of course, as Clifford Geertz says in a classic essay we shall read not too long from now, the business of interpreting culture, which as lawyers we are doing for the purpose of inscribing new purposes in the culture, new meanings by using words, which we could call dramatic writing, in order to make things happen, because it's the happening, which from the lawyer's point of view is why the literature exists. But in the process of that building, the building of that interpretation upon which our expressive action is then predicated, the building of that interpretation means going back and forth between understanding things the way participants understand them and understanding things the way participants do not understand them, because participants do not have a theory of their own participation. From the point of view of the anthropologist, as Geertz says, this is tacking back and forth like a sailboat between ethnography, between trying to record how natives live, and interpretation, hermeneutic, critical activity designed to think about what it means to be a native, having once upon a time pretended enough to be one to have written it down. Thinking from within and thinking from without, presence and absence. And our lawyer's theory, then, is one which can be used to see from within for the purpose of seeing from without, for the purpose of acting from within again. Which is why our theory operates by leaping together, by consilience, by jumping from one position to another, because it has to. Because at one and the same time, one must nearly be in the room thinking about what it means to be a homicide detective doing cybercrime investigations and what it means to be your client, a hopped-up kid with both too much confidence and a deep fear of what might happen to him if he gets arrested again, and you sitting there watching it spinning out of control and wondering exactly what you're going to do in the next 500 milliseconds to bring this evolving catastrophe back into shape. And that might require having both very detailed knowledge of the circumstances you think you're looking at, from the chimpanzee politics level to the Platonic understanding of the purpose of law enforcement, and also absence enough to create an immediate solution as a result of which, well, something's going to happen that nobody expected. At the moment, however, it is still the question, how do I understand law school's predominant concerns well enough to do well on the exam? So let us try to use a little bit of the same kinds of tools that Leff would use on one matter. What is contract, after all, when you get to the place where the lines of supply and demand on the graph actually cross? And how is it different from crime? Let us use some of the same tools to ask what it is that the fundamental principles of common law liability are all about. The way that this is done in law school still recapitulates an essentially 18th century view of an essentially 13th century way of thinking about what the content of law is. Once upon a time I used to teach a seminar called Historical Introduction to Common Law Literature, in which I actually tried with students to read the great books of the common law from Bracton to Holmes, by way, let us say, of Edward Coke and William Blackstone, and to find an intellectual and cultural reason why possession of an understanding of the literary classics of the common law might be useful to a real lawyer in the real world. A couple of people who took that seminar went out and did interesting things as real lawyers in the real world, and I don't know whether their acquaintance with Bracton and Cook and Blackstone actually helped them or not. We could ask them sometime when we can all see one another again. But in the meantime, let me just point out that the way that a 13th century treatise affected an 18th century treatise is still why we have courses called contract, torts, and property, but we wouldn't have to do it that way if we didn't want to, and there might be another way to do it. Those three basic forms of the common law liability structure, the contracts and the torts and the property, can be understood a little more clearly if we think, as Leff and Goffman might ask us to think about it, what the drama is that lies behind each of them. The law of contracts is essentially the law of the protection of expectations. The principle that whether deals are done discreetly, cash for a cow, or they are done relationally, as Ian McNeil famously put it, in a, let us say, a collective bargaining agreement between General Motors and the United Auto Workers designed to last 6 years and to embody the principles under which their growing, changing relationship will, in tens of thousands of little details over the course of those years, define how their relationship feels to the parties who are in them. Contracts, whichever they are, however discreet or however relational or short or long or con-like or sales-like, are about expectations and their protection in the law. Where contract defeats expectations, where contract law deals with situations in which expectations will not be protected by the courts, it gets all ashamed of itself. And it rubs its hands, Pontius Pilate fashion, to give excuses for the non-priority attached to expectations in situations like frustration or unconscionability, as Leff himself so brilliantly pointed out. Contract, then, is the way in which common law liability tracks the drama of the protection of expectations. Torts, on the other hand, is the form in which common law liability responds to that which nobody expects, but which is going to happen anyway. Ambrose Bierce in The Devil's Dictionary defines accident as an inevitable occurrence owing to the operation of immutable natural laws. And this is, of course, also what Torts thinks it is, if Torts is a thinker. Torts about the bunker oil that couldn't burn and the rat poison that couldn't explode and all that stuff, as you recall. And all the ways in which we use mechanisms of contract, that is to say, insurance. Oh, but we never really talk about insurance and torts. It's like talking about air resistance in first-year physics. It makes all the math too complicated. Nobody wants to do it. So, in fact, torts rejects that conversation, no matter how much it may be in the casebook of cases and materials. Tort tries to stick to the principle of, oh my God, how did that happen, and what do we do about it now? There is, of course, the cost of accidents, and that's the way in which, as Leff would say, the useful tools of microeconomics, what Arnold would call the folklore of law and economics, comes back in. Whether it's about the question of whether employers should be liable for the illnesses contracted by their employees during the epidemic, or whether it is about who should bear the cost of all the frozen Texans, the problem of what we do about the things that we couldn't see coming but that were actually inevitable anyway is what we like to think of as tort. Which means, of course, planning, because that for which no expectations arose among the individuals were supposed to be the places where the just state stepped in and did some previous calculation and made some rules against having slicers in delicatessens with one-hand controls or etc. Property, then, is the space in which the two forms of primary common law liability, the protection of expectations and the reasoning about the post hoc treatment of the unexpected by planning, come together. The dramas of contract and of tort acting themselves out are, well, as night and day. But the drama of property embraces always both. Someday, my son, this will all be yours, on the one hand, and you can't put a tannery next to a school, on the other. So property is the place in which the protection of expectations and the management of the built and planned environment in the world of expectation defeating responsibility for what happens to happen come together and meet in a tournament. The ongoing drama of property is the meeting of those two in tournament, where the rules can neither be entirely about the preservation of expectations, nor can they be entirely about planning for the occurrences we didn't see coming that always happen. If we know this, we could conceivably teach the courses differently. We could have one course in the primaries of common law liability, in which expectations and planning, accident and defeat of expectation and exclusion as a principle of segregation, of risk and reward, can all be taught at once in relation to one another. After which, with the spine in place, we can then hang a lot of different pieces: commercial transactions, secured transactions, landlord-tenant law, nuisance, digital regulation, all sorts of courses that are valuable in different parts of law school can then be attached at the ends of the spars which arise from the masts of the three-masted schooner, which is the principles of common law liability. We don't do it that way, as you know. You have contracts, and you have torts, and you have property, and yet there's nothing to prevent you from thinking about all the material at once and arranging it according to the categories it naturally possesses and then going in and writing about it on the exams. In this particular instance, of course, some of the exams have already happened, and some of them are yet to come because this is the first year of law school. But the principles all exist within one frame in which you can present yourself as knowing something deeper, which is the sort of impression that students might want to make. Leff is, of course, showing how one portion of this framing can be used to provide for one element of destabilization, that is, the removal of the line between swindling and selling, which, from one perspective, it is valuable to do. And knowing that it can be done should suggest a variety of ways in which it can be done in other directions and in other fields for similar or at least rhyming purposes. What Leff is doing is enabling us to ask questions, to generate new positions from which to ask yet more questions predicated on the questions we can get to if we slightly displace the frame by breaking its corners and adding more pieces than the frame originally held. The image of law school with which you are generally working and which the epidemic oddly reinforces is that law school is a series of unbreakable frames and mandatory meetings. This is grotesquely false. It's easier to see that it's grotesquely false when you can see it. That is to say, when there is a building called a law school and there are people in it and, well, you can see their faces. We understand human beings based upon 5 million years of experience since we and our chimpanzee cousins parted company and the hominid primates began to move in new and wonderful ways. We are, as I say in the first section of the book I'm writing now, we are who we are because of our ability to teach one another. And in the great first era of the human race, before articulate spoken language of a complex kind began, say, 200,000 years ago, a tiny space in the longer history of us, in the long first era of us, before complex articulate spoken language, things happened in society anyway, they just didn't use words. And our primary understanding of ourselves was based not in interpreting words, but interpreting body language, facial expression, gesture, and all the other parts of the nonverbal communication in which we taught one another by example, not by precept, and became human beings and made language out of which we made our poems and our laws. But that deep foundation underneath requires us to see and understand one another in ways which aren't possible on Zoom. separate, each in our little cubicles of quarantine, dealing only with those people whom we must care for and care about under circumstances of powerful human disorganization and disillusionment. Because, of course, when we are all banged up together, we lose our illusions about one another. And therefore, we gain illusions about those with whom we are not all banged up together. And if there is no law school, then we illusorily create a law school. And it is far less flexible and far more rigid than we would know it was if we could see it. So you imagine law school to be less capable of change in the little flexible ways that the confidence trickster is always changing things with, and more capable of change by revolution. Well, you see, because of course it's easier to imagine a revolution from a cubicle than out there in the world where you'd really have to make it happen, and it's hard. The activity of the dean and whichever committee of people it was she drew together in order to deal with you over the grading system demonstrates why it is important to understand where the flexibility is and where it isn't in a system, and in order to do that you must look at its drama closely, and the drama just worked on you should indicate the value of other approaches now. The real flexibility of law school is its infinite plasticity in relation to your acts of imagination. And then the question is, how to imagine? And as you notice, as you come to the opportunity to submit the first bad draft of the first essay, nothing is more important for moment-to-moment satisfaction, or at least relief of anxiety in isolation, than to have exactly the manual containing exactly the rule book for how to have an idea. And there isn't any manual for how to have an idea, but the world is full of poems. And there isn't actually one way to know why contracts are done, or one equation in which to sum it up, some hand formula or other, I suppose, though that would be over there in the other course. Instead, there's just the beauty of improvising under conditions of both opportunity and stress. There's just the task of making it new every day. Thus, at one and the same time, achieving the skill of the artist and the prosperity of the, well, the partner. Building a way of understanding what it means to do lawyering that gives you the pleasure of lawyering and the curiosity about how to be a better lawyer that from day to day causes you to read and watch and review and participate in the surrounding drama so as to have a growing character, rather than a type within which you are always cast. Talk to you soon.